I've called today's message Breaking Out of the Performance Box. Okay? There's something dangerous that happens when the strange becomes familiar. When the strange becomes familiar, it is easy to think that answers are so simple, that messages are common sense, and that we know what something means before we hear it, because we do. Anyone that questions that logic, who can point out a contradiction in the familiar, who can point out a contradiction in the original message and how we live now, is just not with the program. The Sermon on the Mount will be close to 2,000 years old. Have you thought of that? 2,000 years old. It has been reflected on and spoken on and written about for 2,000 years. That's a long time. And it's long enough for the strangeness that would have been in the atmosphere of the first hearers to become logical common sense now. Think about it. The people that first heard the message would be going, what is he going on about? Have you ever said that when you've read the Sermon on the Mount yourself? After all, today we know the poor are blessed because the kingdom of heaven is theirs. We know it's just common sense that we are salt. And if we lose our saltiness, we are worthless. We know that. It's common sense. Every Christian knows that Jesus came to fulfill the law. And everyone in this room knows that anger towards someone would be subject to the same judgment as murder. And we know from last week the danger of taking oaths. It's all common sense. All of this is familiar. It's not a strange message. If I started today talking about pigs and goats, that would be a strange message. And as a result, the learning for us is often an affirmation, isn't it? It affirms what we already know, even if the affirmation is an ongoing challenge. And there is a danger in that. The danger is we fail to see what the message was challenging the original hearers to do, and what the message is challenging ourselves to do today. When the strange becomes familiar, our ears become a little bit more blocked. Why listen to Fiona preaching today? We've had it already. We've had it for 2,000 years. The Sermon on the Mount was not just a message of wisdom bringing sense to the Torah. That was one part of it. The Sermon on the Mount was a call for a whole new way of life. If you want to look at what we've talked about, open your Bibles and look at Matthew 5. I'm not going to be preaching on Matthew 5, but that's where Jesus starts. Look at it as I'm talking and go, what is the strangeness in here? It was a call to a whole new way of life. And in order to see this, we have to make the familiar strange again, so that the blinkers that are on our own eyes are removed. Because if we acknowledge that the Sermon on the Mount is 2,000 years old, we have to admit, over 2,000 years, we've yet to actually live this whole new life Jesus has called us to do. It's been repeated for 2,000 years. It tells us that some ears have been blocked. The challenge continues today. So I want to ask you, do you find the Sermon of the Mount challenging? Because if we go on living like we live now, we risk something. We risk walking a hypocrite life, a life where our faith is a performance, like that motorbike outside, all noise, no substance. Now, before we jump into the scriptures, I'm going to provide a little bit more context into why I'm suggesting we need to make the words of Jesus strange to us again in order to see our own blindness to the message. Are you ready for it? So, confession time. I have a background in an academic field called sociology. I'm not going to turn you all off, I promise. In short, sociology is the study of community. So social, study of the social, study of community. Psychology, psycho is inside the head, study of the brain. That's how you work it out. Ology is Greek for study of or love of. So my background is sociology, the study of community. In sociology, we argue that the issues that happen in our society, in our community, in individuals and in families are caused by how a society forms itself. Particularly how a society or a community sets up the rules, the structures, and the institution, and how a society or a community defines what is success. What's important here, and even sociologists admit this, like myself, sociology is interested in how a society forms itself. A society is made out of humans, not God. It's important to realise. So back in the day when I was teaching sociology, I would ask my students a typical sociological question, a Dr. Fee question, a question that determines what a community values. And I'd put this question into a New Zealand context. I'd ask very simply, and I'd have a whiteboard right there, get my whiteboard pen out, and I'd ask, what does it mean to be a successful New Zealander? These are the answers that my students would give me. To be successful in New Zealand, you would end up owning your own house. You would have a successful job. You would make reasonable money. You would have a family. You would have social status in your community. You'd have education. The list goes on. They're not bad things, but they're all things that New Zealand says, this is what makes a successful New Zealander. And then I'd point out this very real fact. Not everyone will achieve these goals. And that for some people, these goals are simply not achievable from the onset. I come from a very poor family. I remember my mum's 60th. And my uncle saying, when she was born, my mum was born and closed adopted. My uncle said she was given a bad hand of cards to start off with. Some of us in New Zealand are born into wealth. Some are born into poverty. It's real. For some of us, these goals, these things that determine success could be ripped up from our feet with unexpected changes. And I'd say to my students, Wainui Amata is a really good example of this. In the 1980s, you could expect that every man, I'm saying every man because it was back in the 80s, it was often one income homes, every father would have a job. There were factories everywhere. People in this room will remember that there were factories in the valley. New government, new policy, the factories closed down. The jobs went offshore. Overnight, Wainui Amata changed. The community I lived in, Westport, back in the day, it was called a coal corp. It was coal mining. Overnight, half of the men lost their jobs. They had no choice. It was gone. And I'd point out that people would respond to the situation in different ways. And I'm just going to focus on two here because I get, this is sociology is where I come from, okay? So I get really, really passionate. It's like if you get Royce to talk about electricity, you'll probably have him talking for 6 hours straight. So I'm not going to go right into the causes and all this stuff, but I can tell you I can do it. But I'm going to just talk about two responses that could happen. You've got these goals, you've got these determinants of success. One group of people might choose, well, we haven't got the money that they've got over in Eastbourne, but we're going to just find innovative ways to achieve these goals. I want these goals, but I can't get them in the usual way, so I'm going to start my own business. I'm going to start a drug business. That will mean I can own a house, have a family, have money, have social status. The second group will rebel and go, stuff it. I'm going to make my own goals and reject these. And I would say to my students, you're going, where is she going? This is the Sermon on the Mount. I'll say to my students, Christians fall into both of these camps. Christians fall into the innovation camp and the rebellious camp. And actually, if Christians were being Christians, I'll say this to my students, in a university, in a lecture theatre of 200 students, I would say if Christians were really being Christians, they would be in the rebellious camp. They wouldn't be innovating to try to get all these determinants of success for New Zealanders. They would actually go, we are called to a different set of goals, a different set of values. We are called to holy rebellion. Now, I'm not saying having a job and a home is a bad thing, but I'm saying that some of us in this room are comfortable with where we sit as New Zealanders. We have a home. A job. We have social status. And I'm saying that someone telling us that these are not markers of kingdom success, when you die and you get to the gates, and if it's St. Peter there, I don't know, just going to Catholic tradition, is he going to go, Eric, that's a good man, you achieved your goal, you got your job, you did this, you got it, good job, come on in. Is that what is going to get you into the kingdom? And there are some in this room, who struggle with the markers of New Zealand success. There are some in this room who don't own their own home. And no matter how they try, they may not own their own home. There's some that have to have a job of a cleaner. And whilst they might love that job, New Zealanders don't value cleaners. And I would say to my students, why is it that my mother, who was a cleaner for the bulk of her life, has calloused hands now, can't afford a retirement? What makes her job less valuable than the Prime Minister of New Zealand when it comes to pay packets? There'll be some in this room today that feel like outsiders, because they just don't seem to have what marks success in New Zealand. In the Sermon of the Mount, it is these outcasts that Jesus is talking to. He is talking to the outsiders, the ones that were struggling. He was talking to those who struggled to achieve success in the eyes of the Roman and Jewish world. They just couldn't make it in either of those spaces. And Jesus was talking to the outsiders, confirming a new way of living, while telling the Pharisees, get out of the ritual of getting these goals differently in your own ways and get with the righteous living program. He's telling both groups, the answer's not to innovate and try to fit into the world box. The answer is to create another box altogether. And I have yet to see the church in our history, 2,000-year-old history, create another box. In fact, if you look at Christian history, the first step, as soon as Christianity became a recognized religion, was to create a church system that looked like the Roman Empire. We keep mimicking the world in everything we do. All of our programs mimic the world. Our reaction is to innovate. So are you really prepared to make the familiar strange? Are you really prepared to live your faith differently? because it won't be about status and how others see you. It'll be about your heart. It'll be about your attitude. It'll be about how God sees you. Because if you've taken the last few weeks to heart, you'll know your faith is not a performance. It's a heart way of living. What's hit me really deeply in the last few weeks, it's a heart way of living together. How do we respond to each other? How do we respond to those who hurt us? That's the Sermon of the Mount. So if that lengthy introduction, one that will get me a D grade at Bible college, we will jump into the Word. I'm reading from Matthew 6, and Di is going to put the words up because I'm also breaking Bible college rules, and I'm reading from the Message. Be especially careful when you're trying to be good so that you don't make a performance out of it. It might be good theatre, but the God who made you won't be applauding. When you do something for someone else, don't call attention to yourself. You've seen them in action, I'm sure. Play actors. Now, I do like NIV better. Hypocrites, I call them. Treating prayer meetings and street corner alike as a stage, acting compassionate as long as someone is watching, playing to the crowds. They get applause, true, but that's all they get. When you help someone out, don't think about how it looks. Put on your Nikes and just do it. Quietly and unobtrusively. This is the way your God, who conceived you in love, working behind the scenes, helps you out. And when you come before God, don't turn that into a theoretical production either. All of these people making a regular show out of their prayers, hoping for stardom, do you think God sits in a box seat? Here's what I want you to do. Find a quiet, secluded place so you won't be tempted to role play before God. Just be there as simply and as honestly as you can manage. The focus will shift from you to God. And you will begin to sense His grace. The world is so filled of so-called prayer warriors and prayer ignorant. They're full of formulas and programs and advice, peddling techniques for getting what you want from God. Don't fall for that nonsense. This is your Father you are dealing with, and He knows you better than He knows better than you what you need. Moving to verse 16. When you practice some appetite-denying discipline to better concentrate on God, don't make a production out of it. It might turn you into a small-time celebrity, but it won't make you a saint. If you go into training inwardly, act normal outwardly. Shampoo and comb your hair, brush your teeth and wash your face, even if camping in Africa. God doesn't require attention-getting devices such as claiming to camp in Africa. He won't overlook what you're doing. He'll reward you well. In these verses, Jesus has moved from the wisdom of righteous living found in the Torah, which he talks about in chapter 5, to the enacting out of religious practices. Now notice I said he moved on. He's not moving away from one part of the message to the other. In fact, what I want to suggest is if you've got that first part right, the righteous living part right, your faith isn't a performance. If you've got it right, if you've got your relationship with your brother right, then this becomes the outward enacting of that. Because even in the church, Christians hold grudges. And guess what? That's our blindness to the message of the Sermon on the Mount. You cannot hold a grudge and think that you're living the Sermon on the Mount. So if you understand the principles of God's kingdom, what we call the Beatitudes, I'm now calling that Beatitude. If you understand the principles of God's kingdom, if you understand the place of the law and how to enact the principles of the law, then you'll know that your faith needs to be more than a performance. Jesus is directly challenging and talking into a societal marker of success found in the social groups of his time, and that continues here today, and that is the marker of social status. You know, when we just recently did our church family our family forum, and we did our AGM, and we voted for the elders, how many of us actually were thinking about what's going on inside people's hearts? Because often what we're judging people on in their spiritual walk is on what we actually see. And hopefully, because I know, just because I was one of the ones, but hopefully my faith myself, just talking to myself here, is more than just a performance. See, even back in that day, the social status of being seen as religious and holy was important in the place of Judea. It wasn't a marker of Roman success, but it was a marker of Jewish success living under the oppression of Roman rule. That's a very good Pharisee, sticking to the Torah with all of this oppression happening around us, refusing to even buy stuff with this coin because it's got the head of Pharaoh on it. What an exceptionally holy person. Let's give that person some status. Today, being seen as, I have got here religious, but we don't like that word, so I'll just say being seen as holy, okay? Being seen as holy is not one of New Zealand's success, but it is one of Christian success. It's an innovative way for us in this church to achieve one of the social markers of successful New Zealanders, social status. I can actually say, my name's worth nothing out there, but it's worth something in here. You see what I mean? Social status has a place in Christianity. Now, I don't say a place, it's an unholy place. It's a reality that we inadvertently hold people up on pedestals. But being seen as religious and holy is just that. It's being seen. It's a performance. Particularly when the praise of others is what feeds you. Even when you do in your own righteous way, relabel that praise as encouragement. Jesus gives three explicit examples of religious performances: generosity, prayer, and fasting. And I would add it, would take it a guess that if he was preaching to the church today, he might add to that list worship, purchasing of Christian books and movies and whatnot. You know, how many pictures and signs have you got up in your own home, sort of thing, and attending Christian events. Now, none of these things he is saying not to do. In fact, you will find he actually says, be generous, pray to your Father often, fast. He's saying and demonstrating all these things. So he's not saying don't do it. And even when he says do these things in private, he is not saying that these things must only be done in private. What he's saying is, what feeds you when you do this? When you do something publicly, what is feeding you? Are you doing it to get acknowledgement from others? Or do you just not give a toss and you're going to do it anyway? Is your religious, and that's intentional now, is your religious practicing, your faith-based practicing, Is that about your relationship with your father? Because if this is not the first desire, then you're living in the wrong box. I'd suggest you're in the innovative box. Get yourself into the righteous rebellion box, because that's where it starts. You know, none of us in this room are immune from wanting to be in the box of comfort, the box that comes with the recognition from others. And don't get me wrong, it's good to encourage. But for those of us receiving encouragement, where is our heart at in our initial reaction or our initial action? When we first did something, where was our heart at? I'm going to give a really personal example here. This is very personal because here I am preaching something that is actually, this is actually hard stuff. And I'm not joking, it's hard stuff because it literally is. Where is your heart at? You know, I actually think when Jesus came and he was talking to the Pharisees and the Sadducees and the Essenes, often that was what he was trying to say to them. Where is your heart at? In all of this performance and all of this action, where is your heart at? Because it's not about you. It's about your Creator. So this example was a deep lesson that I had to have. It involves Eric, but it was a lesson for me. And it was a lesson that even though my intention was good, my heart was in the wrong place to begin with. In this example, my intention was godly. And even to this day, when I look back, I know that God had asked me to do this. But I was doing it also to get a thank you from people. So I did something, and I was doing it also to get a thank you. Now, I didn't realize that until I got hurt afterwards, because I didn't get the thank you. Okay, so quite some time ago, Eric and I, we gave substantially into an area of our church family. Now, we're talking thousands of dollars. It's a very specific area, and the recipients experience the reward of our investment directly. And I should say that none of the people in the story are here today. They never knew how much money it cost Eric and I, and we never told them, but they would have known there was money involved. But Eric and I, we were following Matthew to the T. You know, we were following Matthew 6 to the T. We gave in secret. Yes, they knew that something had been given, but they had no idea how much. They had no idea fully the source of it or anything. But they did know that I was one of the key people involved in the giving. Now, near the end of the time, we received a complaint that what we had given wasn't up to expectation. We never received a thank you. Now, I notice even now that everyone is siding with me. No, I'm the bad guy in this story, okay? Because actually, you'll get it once you get the lesson I learned. And you know, this is the part of where, and I'm actually really pleased I'm actually sharing this now, because I'm going to click onto this, give you a teachable moment. So when everyone started to side on my side and say, well, you know, these people complained. You know, they were given thousands. We are talking thousands, not small numbers here, thousands. That story worked like a parable would have worked for Jesus. Because in a parable, people were always positioned in different places. And often, the lesson was with a group that they thought the lesson wasn't for. You know, hold on to that thought. So here we go, given all this money, never got a thank you. It really hurt deeply. And I held a grudge. Rightfully so. I was righteously holy. I didn't tell anyone in this church, you know, this is the first time, and we're talking over a decade ago, I've been here a while, so it's, I was the giver. God calls us to give. They never said thank you. And they complained that it wasn't good enough. I deserved a thank you. I'm sorry. If they're not going to give a thank you, they can go and find another place, another room to live in heaven, because it's not going to be near me. I I'm sharing this story not because the people in this story were wrong. Remember, you don't know who they are. And if you did, you might turn to me and say, actually, Fiona, did you know this was going on in their life? Did you know this? Did you know this? Did you know this? They're not here to defend their position. So anyone that jumps onto my side and say, I was the good person, you don't know their story. Remember, no one knew, though, in this, how much we had given. And we never actually, when we originally gave it, asked for a thanks. We never did that. We never even asked for an acknowledgement when we gave it. We did what it says. We secretly gave it. And you know our God, he always makes sure people say thank you. But the deep lesson of the story was for me, and it was a very deep lesson. It was a performance. Get with the program, Fiona. You gave that money hoping, like anything, you would get a thank you. You wanted recognition. Get with the program, Fiona. Your heart is in the wrong place. I had to learn a very powerful lesson, and I remember talking with Pastor Paul at the time. It was a lesson of grace and mercy. When our Saviour came to this world, our King came to this world that we sung about, oh, the joy on his heart of every single being in his creation, every single human turned to him and said, thank you for the sacrifice you've made on the cross for us. The joy in his heart. And yet, even to this day, his heart will be broken knowing that even though he sacrificed his only begotten son, not everyone's going to say thank you. But that didn't stop God doing it. And he knew that he wasn't going to get a thanks. And there'll be some people that God is grieving so much about. We're talking billions and trillions and whatever the thing is above trillions. His heart is weeping. I learned that the grace that was freely given on the cross, an expectation of nothing in return, that grace freely given to me, I needed to freely give others. Mercy, which is the key of forgiveness, given on that cross freely for me, I had to give it to others. And I was wrong. I was wrong giving, expecting a thank you. Where does it say in the Bible, give and expect a thank you? Where does it say in the Bible, give only if you get a thank you? Where does it say that? It says it in the innovation box of Christianity, that Christians who give, they'll get thanks and they'll get social status in their world, and people look at them saying they're holy. And if that was the case, you would have known all about this 10 years ago, 10 or more years ago when we did it. Because it would have been something that Paul said, oh, Fiona, come and share this testimony at the church on how much you gave and the implications of that. No. Christians are called to the holy rebellious box. I am to give, give, give. And in fact, one of the most amazing email signatures in this church that I have seen is, you are blessed to be a blessing. Every single time God blesses me, it's not for me, it's for others. That whole concept of goodness will follow you. It's not good things will come to you. It's every time you step into obedience of the Father, goodness will follow you and it will flow into other people's lives. That is the secret. But we struggle to walk in this box because we want to hold that grudge. Or we want to look at things differently. We want to say that person who lost their job, it was their own fault. That person And that, you know, and this is how I teach it when I was teaching sociology. So the amount of blame that was put on the men of Wainuiomata in that time, and the shaming that went on every time they turned up to Wins to go for a job, it was real. And the reality was there were no jobs for them. The reality was that, but New Zealand never said that. New Zealand said, a person who tries hard gets a job. I don't think that's the message Jesus came to say. Jesus came to say, where are you for that man? And blessed is that man. I learnt in that moment that I was to never stop giving, never stop praying, never stop fasting, never stop purchasing or buying Christian teachings. But I learnt in all of that that my blessing was being a blessing to others. Everything God gives us is to give to others, every talent. As some of you know, I play the guitar. That talent is no use if I'm playing at home. In fact, it just causes the neighbours to call noise control. Okay. That talent comes to use here in this community. That's where the talent comes to use. I learned a powerful Sermon of the Mount principle back then, because the initial expectation of the giving really was a thank you. At the end of the day, all I wanted was acknowledgement. And because my initial expectation was that thank you, I became angry. And very on in the Sermon of the Mount, we learn the judgment of my anger at that moment. It's the same of murder. But it was holy anger. The sermon tells me that holding anger towards others brings God's judgment. I also, believe it or not, made an oath at that time that I was never going to give to anyone else in this church. Jesus also challenges us. When you give oaths, you've got to stick to them. And sometimes I'm going to challenge you, he says. You know, sometimes I'm actually going to say, is that a righteous oath? I learnt I had to get my righteous living towards God and others right in my life to ensure that all my practices of faith, even in public, would be reflective of my relationship with my Father. That's what I learnt. That's why I say, it might be a new chapter in your Bible, but Jesus didn't speak in chapters and verses. You're reading a full sermon. When he goes on from the Beatitudes to the examples he gives around the Torah, and he jumps into this bit about don't be hypocrites, it's the same sermon. It's the same sermon. So he is saying, if you actually know what it means to be blessed, the Beatitudes, if you actually know what the Father means by the Torah, the 613 commands, which can be broken down into two commands, what are they? Exactly, love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind and spirit, and love your neighbour as yourself. Everything gets consumed in those two things. Now no one can tell me that God, that Jesus came to do away with those two things. Jesus came to fulfill those two things, and for 2,000 years, we haven't got it right. I'm not saying we've read the scriptures wrong. I'm saying we've probably read them right. But we haven't enacted them because we still hold grudges. I can put it down to that one principle. We still hold grudges. And as long as we're holding grudges, we fail to do that, and our faith becomes a performance. And our faith becomes a performance. So you have learned through my testimony that there was a time where I did an act that was a performance act, and then God's tapping me going, actually, Fiona, it was a teachable moment for me. So you have given Linda of a teachable moment that God used in my life to teach me to walk in a different way when I give. So what about you? Is your Christian faith a performance, or is it a heart transformation? What are the markers of success in your life? More importantly, what are the markers of success in your Christian walk? And then even more importantly is, how has God blessed you in order for you to bless others? I've got my holy shoes on. Some people will know what that means. Finally, I personally think it's time that we as a church begin to consider how we enact our vision for the valley. Don't look at me. Look at that wall. We exist to provide a local place of worship to help establish Wainuiomata as a Christ-centered community by promoting biblical values and positively impacting the lives of those around us. Because enacting this vision would see us challenging our conceptions of social success. There's nothing about houses there. There's nothing about jobs. There's nothing about social status. We would move from those markers to the principles of the Sermon on the Mount. I really believe that. If we really reflect on how we as a church enact our own vision, we would walk differently together. We can't be a Christ-centered community without Christ in the center. We would put God above all others, and we would treat our neighbours how we ourselves would like to be treated. To finish, I believe that if we really, really hone in on our vision together, not as individuals, this is what we would see. Forgiveness is our doorstep. Mercy, the keys to our whare, the keys to our house, and grace, the doorway. Forgiveness is our doorstep. Mercy, the keys to our whare, and grace, the doorway. To me, that would mean that everyone that enters through our doors would feel welcomed, loved, and accepted. There would be no outsiders here, because we are all outsiders together. Forgiveness is our doorstep, mercy the keys, and grace. Forgiveness is our doorstep, mercy the keys, and grace our doorway. Tēnā koutou, tēnā koutou, tēnā koutou katoa.